Spectator is having a flash sale. Get 12 issues of the magazine for just £12, in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a bottle of Johnny Walker Black Label Whiskey, completely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale. Be quick, the offer ends on Monday.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Every week we pick a few of our writers who will read their pieces in the magazine that week for you. This episode will be joined by Rod Liddell, who gives his take on the public sector pay freeze. He'll be followed by Paul Embry, who writes about how the Labour Party needs to find its working class roots again. And at the very end, Rachel Johnson despairs that Christmas is back on. First, Rod Liddell.
I wonder how much more money we will have to bung the teachers in order to inculcate within them an amenability towards doing a spot of teaching. They still seem terribly averse to the whole idea. During the first lockdown, 60% of young children received no virtual lessons at all from teaching staff, and one in five pupils over 12 was given no work to do, according to the Children's Commissioner. Virtual lessons shouldn't have been terribly difficult to arrange, but most of the time there were none. My own daughter had no virtual lessons from March to July, which is why she's no longer in the state sector. She did, however, complete five physics papers, and being scatty, sent them, one after the other, to the wrong email address. Nobody anywhere noticed. When we rang the school to inquire about online lessons, we were told mimsy stuff about how our priority should be to protect her mental well-being during this terribly stressful time, yada yada. One head teacher in the Northeast reported that almost her entire staff was sitting at home on their asses doing nothing at all. When lockdown was lifted on the 4th of July, it was gently suggested that perhaps the kids might get a bit of tuition over the summer, but the unions went berserk. They seem to demand a kind of permanent lockdown, where they never have to teach anybody anything at all. It seems highly likely to me that the kids will be given no exams next summer, for example, thus freeing the teachers from even the mild rigours of preparing their charges for tests. In that weird anti-lacuna of activity between lockdowns, whole classrooms of kids were sent home for a week or so, if one of them showed as much as a sniffle. Anyway, the reward for these months of near total inaction was a pay rise of 3.1%, easily the largest within the public sector. The less they work, the more money they get. But then this is the hallmark of the public sector, which has thrived during this crisis, like blue bottles on the corpse of a gassed badger. Jobs in the private sector, you know, the sector that enables us to pay for everything, reduced by 51,000 from March through to September, while public sector jobs increased by 39,000. The same contrast was there with earnings. Over the year to June, public sector weekly earnings increased by 4.1%. while those in the private sector reduced by 2.4%. Even before COVID struck, average weekly wages in the public sector, 632 quid since you asked, were ahead of those in the private domain, 570 quid. This is Chancellor Rishi Sunak's major problem. Yes, of course, the economy in general doesn't look too healthy, but worse is the fact that we will have, predating upon it, a bloated public sector suffused with an inordinate sense of its own worth, and to whom, most likely, we must pay obeisance once every week by taking a knee or banging together pots and pans. You can judge the robust nature of the health of our public sector by the size of the lefty protest marches every few days in London. I doubt anyone on an Extinction Rebellion or BLM march works in the private sector, all unemployed, public sector or third sector. I tried to find someone who wasn't on the public payroll during a Stop the Cuts, Tory Scum Out demo a few years back. Couldn't find a single one, I'm afraid. Mr. Sunak's public sector pay freeze then has come several 2 months late for my liking, and those supposed cuts occasioned by austerity merely graze the surface. An expanding and ever more voracious public sector plus a declining private sector is not a healthy recipe. In fact, it's a kind of delusion. Meanwhile, we now have a sort of gentle civil war in the country between the people, who are desperate to be put in the government's most congenial Tier 1 once lockdown is over, and their public sector local officials, who want the entire country placed in Tier 4 forever. Yes, I realise there isn't a Tier 4 yet. But there is no possible list of restrictions which Steve Pie Muncher, Labour, urban mayor of Ferret Hell and Methadone, wouldn't find wholly inadequate. Nobody must go anywhere at any time. Nothing must be open. Nobody must go to work. But in the meantime, please, we need millions of quid to help us out, assuage us in our self-flagellation and complete bone idleness. Cash from that magic money tree, grown somewhere else by someone else. This is more of a problem than it sounds. We will emerge one day from this holiday from life with Labour-governed areas and the public sector in general having become used to being doled out vast amounts of taxpayers' largesse and with a shrunken private sector. The expectations from the likes of Mr. Pie Muncher will be for more and more money, a kind of unceasing fountain of other people's cash. And, given the government's willingness to spend and spend again during this crisis, he will not be easily placated. The government will sooner or later be forced into substantial tax rises, which, for Pie Muncher et al., is the only moral way of averting bankruptcy. Yes, take more of other people's money. We know what higher taxes do to an economy, especially one which has endured a longish period of suffering. A spur to growth is lower taxes and a pared-back state, but such a policy has become almost impossible to advance in the current climate. We will emerge from this lockdown and move swiftly into another in all but name. And then, after we've been allowed to see the rallies at Christmas, into another. Does anyone seriously believe that this will all be over by Easter, as the government seems to be implying? Do you recall them telling us it would be all over by May, and then September, and then Christmas?
That was Rod Liddell, and now Paul Embury.
I love the Labour movement. I love its history, its traditions, its brass bands and banners. I love its rousing songs, anthems and festivals. I love its slogans and rallying cries, inspired as they are by an abiding faith in the collective spirit and the seductive vision of the New Jerusalem. For all that tribalism is given a bad name these days, sometimes with good reason, I feel tribal about my attachment to the Labour movement, and I offer no apology for that. As it was for millions of others who grew up in working class communities, tribalism in the cause of Labour was for me less a matter of choice and more one of imperative. This wasn't like choosing a football team. This was about recognising the place of our people in the prevailing economic order and understanding that advancing our interests meant not waiting submissively for some benevolent ruling class to come to our aid, but organising through our own democratic institutions to challenge society's injustices. It was through the vehicle of the Labour movement that the lives of millions, in the workplace and beyond, were transformed for the better, spiritually as well as materially. Decent wages, robust safety at work laws, paid holidays, sanitary and affordable housing, a welfare system, universal healthcare, these are the things the Labour movement played a pivotal role in securing for people like us. The movement was on our side, and I knew it from early on. It's why I joined a trade union at the age of 16, immediately on landing a Saturday job stacking shelves at the Dagenham branch of Asda, which happened to fall quite literally within the shadow of the famed Ford Motor Plant, the setting for the totemic 1960s struggle of the women machinists, and then the Labour Party 3 years later. It's why I've been a foot soldier of the movement ever since, serving on the executive of a prominent trade union and taking part in more demonstrations, marches and strikes than I care to remember. The movement is not only an intrinsic part of our nation's modern history, but incontestably a force for good, and I would go toe-to-toe with anyone who argues to the contrary. So it grieves me beyond measure to see the movement's wings, both of them, political in the form of the Labour Party, industrial in the form of trade unions, so far removed physically and ideologically from the very people and communities they exist to serve. What began as a strain in the relationship between the party and its traditional working class base in the late 1980s, when the former began to imbibe a poisonous brew of economic and social liberalism, became a decisive fissure 12 months ago when the Red Wall collapsed in spectacular fashion at the general election. The Labour Party, it seemed, was no longer the voice of Labour, and neither were its union partners, who over the same 30 years or so had hemorrhaged members, retreated to their public sector redoubt, and increasingly become the mouthpiece not of ordinary workers, but of the London liberal class. I seek no personal kudos when I say I saw this schism coming a long way off. For more than a decade, through my interventions in the movement and the media, I warned anyone who would listen that a storm was brewing in working class communities and that the left would eventually find itself caught in the eye of it. I knew it first when I saw what was happening in my own backyard in the early years of this century. Here, something greater than a storm, more a whirlwind, was ripping through my home borough of Barking and Dagenham in East London. A hitherto settled working class blue collar community, a Labour heartland, was experiencing the sudden dramatic effects of globalisation in the form of deindustrialisation and rapid demographic change. Production at Ford was on its last legs, entire neighbourhoods were transforming at breathtaking speed, and local services began feeling the strain of a population surge. The foreign-born population of Barking and Dagenham rose by 205% in the decade 2001-11, by far the highest increase of any London borough. During the same period, the percentage of residents identifying as white British plunged from 81 to 49%, the largest decrease of any local authority in England and Wales. Local residents grew anxious. This new world of large-scale and unfettered movements of capital and labour, of swift and deep-seated economic and cultural change, seemed to bring them very few benefits. Yet when they looked to their representatives in the labour movement to speak up for them, they were met with patronising lectures about how their new environment would bring cultural enrichment and improve GDP. These representatives trumpeted the profound changes as a symbol of a modern, vibrant Britain. And if folk objected, well, they were small-minded racists. But for the most part, local people bore no personal ill will towards the new arrivals. Theirs was an anxiety born not of racial bigotry, but of sudden disorientation and dislocation. Their sense of order had been violated, not their sense of race. They were not opposed to immigration per se. Their unease sprang from the sheer speed and scale of the changes and their doubts about the ability of the place to cope. And their fire was directed not at their new neighbours, but at a political establishment comprising mainly an arrogant liberal class that had turned a tin ear to their concerns. Two things happened in those early years of the century to illustrate the depth of local anger. First, Barking and Dagenham returned a dozen BNP councillors at the local elections. It was a desperate last plea for help. Second, large numbers just moved away. In the decade to 2011, 40,000 residents left Barking and Dagenham, for many the only place they'd ever called home. Among them were many of my friends and neighbours. Now they were heading for Kent or the Essex coast, an exodus that some would misdiagnose as white flight, but would better be described as a flight to familiarity. I had a front row seat, as in just a few short years, this stable and harmonious working class community became atomised, volatile and fertile territory for the far right. For Barking and Dagenham, read countless other communities across post-industrial, small town and coastal Britain. It was their alienation that brought us Brexit and the massacre of the Labour Party. Those of us who witnessed firsthand the growing sense of dispossession were not in the least surprised when these political earthquakes occurred. I knew back then that this thing was heading inexorably in one direction. I document these experiences in my new book, Despised: Why the Modern Left Loathes the Working Class. I came to see during those tumultuous years in Barking and Dagenham that large sections of the left, including many of my own allies, actively hated the very people for whom they purported to speak. A left that increasingly saw globalism and cosmopolitan liberalism as the endpoints of all economic and social progress gradually began to harbour a deepening contempt for the small-c conservatism of the working classes and their hankering for something more than money and individual rights, something rooted in the concepts of place and social solidarity. This new left, with its enthusiasm for personal autonomy and open borders, simply couldn't comprehend why those who enjoyed less in the way of opportunity for travel or self-advancement might, as a result, be imbued with a heightened sense of rootedness and belonging. Family, community and relationships take on so much more meaning when strict limitations are placed on your life chances. The private antipathy that many on the modern left felt towards the traditional working classes would eventually evolve into a full-scale culture war against them. If you were out of step, as many who live in these communities still are, with progressive opinion on issues such as immigration, same-sex marriage, state-sponsored multiculturalism, trans rights, or more recently, Black Lives Matter, if you still held true to that old rubbish about faith, family, and flag, then you were beyond the pale. Such attitudes in the minds of much of today's left were redolent of the worst kind of social conservatism and really ought not to be exhibited in civilized society. And with so many of such a mind enjoying positions of authority in our media and public institutions, an environment was created quite purposely in which the expression of such outdated or unfashionable views, particularly by those who held any sort of public profile, was met with fierce denunciation and demands for the transgressor's head on a platter. This soft totalitarianism, for that's what it amounts to, is utterly alien to the labour movement's democratic and pluralist traditions and serves only to widen the gulf between it and the working class. It also provides free kick after free kick to the right, which always benefits far more from culture wars than it does from arguments over economics. I detest the way in which this pernicious ideology has infected my movement, and I want rid of it. I agitate every day for the movement to return to its proud, patriotic, communitarian traditions, rooted in the principles of family, vocation, reciprocity and social solidarity, and to reject the toxic combination of 1960s hyper-liberalism and hard-left authoritarianism, an unappealing fusion of Lenin and Lenin, which has become its stock in trade. Go to the People's History Museum in Manchester and you'll find the earliest example of a trade union banner made for the Tin Plate Workers Society in 1821. Emblazoned in a corner of the banner is the Union flag, a nod to the patriotic sentiments of the society's members. Likewise, attend the annual Durham Miners' Gala and witness the procession of lodge banners displaying images and quotations drawn from the Christian tradition, or study the labour movement's roots in cooperatives, mutuals and friendly societies, the little platoons that were once the lifeblood of civil society. Or think about the rich lineage of socialist newspapers and other literature illustrative of a deep commitment to open debate and diversity of opinion. These things are the heritage of the labour movement, and they should still lie at its heart, rather than the globalism, groupthink and identity politics peddled by so many of its current activists. A confident, thriving labour movement is essential to the well-being of our working class communities. That such a chasm has emerged stands as a tragedy, one for which ultimately the entire nation will continue to pay a price.
That was Paul Embury. Finally, Rachel Johnson.
I'm on the record as being, if not a convicted seasonal denier, at least insufficiently Christmassy. Last year, I interviewed Noel Gallagher for the Christmas cover of a magazine and we bonded over our mutual dread of what our American friends call, dispiritingly, holidays. Christmas Day's the longest day, longer than D-Day, and more stressful, he moaned. You're sitting there exhausted, thinking, and it's only 11 o'clock. For the avoidance of doubt, I love Christmas trees, holly, mistletoe, church services, chestnut stuffing, and mince pies. I do not love schlepping round the shops, all playing Slade on a loop in the sleet, buying things people don't want, and the sense that if I don't tingle with excitement at it all, I'm failing in my Christian duty as a mother and patriot. I resent the pressure, the entire gut and wallet-busting commercial splurge. I tolerate it best as a guest, preferably of one of my sainted sisters-in-law, where I can be hailed as a saviour of all mankind for performing some limited but essential service on the day, like making the bread sauce or playing Scrabble with a maiden aunt. Frankly, far from there being a mutiny of mums if lockdown was extended to embrace Christmas, as one of the red tops predicted, the tinsely silver lining of 2020 was going to be that the great British Christmas was off. Computer, in the shape of the shroud and graph-waving nerds of Sage and Whitehall, had said no, because of COVID. For once, a government restriction almost made sense to me after a year of almost vindictive illogicality. Those under house arrest, in isolation in care homes, and the ban on tennis were only two of the things that broke me. If we couldn't have golf, restaurants, sex, going into other people's houses, holidays, dinner parties, any sort of fun and pleasure at all because it wasn't, in quotes, safe, there was no way, surely, that multi-generational clan gatherings in steamy kitchens at the dead of winter were a good idea. For once, then, I could contemplate watching three middle-aged blokes in suits at a podium telling me what to do and whom to do it with without wanting to break things, or so I thought. As the November lockdown limped on, I began almost to look forward with childish glee to the great mum's Christmas off. For 1 year, we could swerve the extravaganza of excess and wrapping paper and personalised Quality Street toffee tins, not to mention the epic shopping and cooking and clearing up marathon that falls to her indoors. Even Kirsty Allsop, the official queen of Christmas, who has two series on making your own Christmas decorations on Channel 4 as I write, had decreed that this year we were permitted to lie in bed in our pyjamas and order pizza. I think there'll be people who think, great, we don't have to meet up as a family, so no pressure, she allowed. Alleluia! But then, this week, lo, there came tidings of great dismay, I mean joy, as Christmas was saved, Mail Online capitals and headline. It was all back on again, big time. Many households over many days could mingle and make merry, and a loud groan did go out across the land. On the day Christmas was saved, like Port Stanley, by the Tory government, I went for a walk with the journalist and mother of three children, Marina Hyde. Since around March, I've done the heavy lifting, the cooking, the homeschooling, the childcare has fallen on me like it has on most women. And now my Christmas present is to do industrial catering for 5 days, she said. One child had just been sent home to self-isolate, which didn't help the mood. Everyone says it's just a large chicken. So this year, that's what I'm doing, a large chicken. Well, good luck with that, Marina. Another added bonus this year is, of course, COVID secure supermarket shopping. Queuing in the rain outside, even in a good year, it's hard getting all the festive fare and provisions in. The angry headlines about home delivery come earlier every year. There are still 11 weeks until Christmas, but concerned shoppers voiced their fears yesterday over Ocado delivery slots already being snapped up, the Mail on Sunday warned on 11th of October. I put out a poll on Twitter asking my followers what they were up for this Yule. The choice was between pizza in pyjamas or turkey dinner for 20. I sensitively didn't add, followed by burying granny, like some ghastly doomster from Sage. The first choice won by miles, which proves my point. All we wanted was a very merry one of pizza in pyjamas in front of the telly. The people have spoken. But no, we got the Mary Berry Christmas instead. Bah humbug.
That was Rachel Johnson. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and we'd love to hear from you, so do leave us a review or send us an email at podcast@spectator.co.uk to tell us what we can do better. Thanks for listening, and join us again next week.
The Spectator is having a flash sale. Get 12 issues of the magazine for just £12, in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a bottle of Johnnie Walker Black Label Whiskey, completely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/sale. Be quick, the offer ends on Monday.